Well, hello, hello, and welcome back yet again to Culture Cryptids. Love is in the air, yes?
Marginally, maybe.
Marginally.
I don't know.
You have a partner. You would know better than me if love is in the air.
I mean, like, yeah, it is technically Valentine's Day, as we're not recording this on Valentine's Day, but
that. But as people are listening to it, it is Valentine's Day.
Yes. This is yet another love themed episode from us this month of coming on. Let's just face it, Valentine's Day is a corporate scam to make more money. Like, we don't actually do the traditional Valentine's Day things,
but it gives us good candy.
That's true. It does. It has decent candy. I think in the scheme of like the best candy, it's there, but it's not like top tier holiday candy.
So let's rate them, because like candy holidays, like we are like, it is the next to the last candy holiday. So obviously, like, top tier candy holiday is Halloween.
Obviously.
So after that, I think for me is Easter.
Oh, it has to be Easter. Like, come on. Like, Easter has all, you get the Reese's eggs at Easter, and there's just something about the peanut butter and chocolate ratio for those, which is perfect.
Well, like, any of the shaped Reese's like things are better than regular ones because of the ratio. And also, I found out that apparently the formula on those, they make them in a different factory, so the formula is slightly different.
It is.
They taste different. Yeah.
They taste different. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you also get Cadbury cream eggs, which are, I mean, just arguably the best kind of candy. So I would almost like Easter candy almost overtakes Halloween candy for me, but there's more of it around Halloween, so it wins by volume.
Me being the insufferable vegan that I am,
that's true.
Halloween will always be number one for me because it is the one that has the most accessible gummy candy that I can have.
Fair. I do struggle to find like gummies that you can eat when I'm finding our other weird Halloween candy.
Sour Patch Kids, always a safe bet.
Mm-hmm.
And actually most jelly beans. So like that's why Easter is like second. So yeah.
That's fair. Yeah. So Easter's second. And like, I mean, honestly, like I put Christmas third. Like you get a lot of like if you're into peppermint, it's very peppermint heavy holiday. So, but I like peppermint and chocolate, you know, that's pretty good. Pretty good. So
see, that's for me. Like, I think that's why Valentine's is above Christmas for me, because like Christmas is very chocolate heavy, I feel. Mm-hmm. And Valentine's is still one that has enough like suckers and gummy stuff and starbursty things, like things that I can have access to.
I guess it just, Valentine's Day has always seemed like a very wasted and I know I sound like some like down on love person. I'm not, Valentine's Day is kind of a boring holiday. Like, I don't want flowers, okay?
I love flowers.
Some of us have a black thumb, and I'm not a plant lesbian, so I can't do that. I just kill everything. So, flowers are bad. And also, I have cats, which are going to eat them and die, so you have to be really careful about what you bring into the house. Don't bring peace lilies into your house, friends. They're very dangerous for your cat.
I have peace lilies in my house, but I have no animals except for me. Yeah.
Except for you. Yeah. You can have that in your house. No, but overall, I think Valentine's Day is overrated. And that's fine. People love the holiday. Go out, have a really expensive dinner with somebody, you know, have a really good time, appreciate your partner, but appreciate them more than just the one day. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I just love love. I love love. And like, I'm a huge fan of like Galentine's Day because I like doing things with my friends, especially once we're single. So
I really like that philosophy too, of like taking a day that is largely meant for romantic love and turning it into a day that is meant for like all types of love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Friends are like.
Yeah.
And your partner, if your partner is your best friend, you can have both of those. That's fine.
That's true. Like if your partner's your best friend, you get the best of both worlds, which I do. So it's great for me.
Yeah, you don't have to rub it in. Okay. It's fine. It's fine.
I've actively been trying not to this entire time. So
it's okay. I will cry myself to sleep later. Before we get too deep in, maybe introductions are in order.
Yes.
Yes. I am JD and I like to bump uglies with the things that go bump in the night.
And I am Corey, and no, I will not stop referring to the D&D Guide to Monster Handbook as the waifu manual. And if you couldn't guess by that intro, welcome to a new thing for us, the first of a two-part episode on romancing the monster.
Yes, some romancing the monster, some monster fucking, a little boy meets ghoul, whatever you want to call it.
Whatever floats your boat.
Yeah, whatever
No,
floats your boat.
really, like this is all
Literally,
about
whatever floats your
whatever
boat.
floats your
Yeah.
boat.
So I think with this one, what we're going to do is we have a few movies we would like to discuss that are kind of in theme with this to get us kind of rolling and started. And then in our next episode, we'll kind of take it from there, right?
To kind of give you a primer guide to movies that if you haven't seen that you should watch, or that if you've seen, we'll kind of just gonna get a chance to talk about them because these are some of my favorites. And I'm very glad that like I know you had seen most of them, but I'm glad I got to share another one of my favorites with you for this episode.
Yeah, no, I always enjoy getting a new one in. I think I like the formula of having like one that's like a tried and true one that I've seen and then one that I haven't seen, because it like I don't know, there's something about that that kind of helps dissect them as well. No, yeah, that's fantastic. And if it wasn't clear from the way we've structured this, we're giving y'all homework. That's what we're doing.
Oh. Yes. Well, these are three movies I think that you should watch in
Yes,
general if
yes.
you like horror and horror adjacent, because in this context, I think most of these films are, I would say, more horror adjacent than straight tried and true horror films.
Only one of them, I would say, kind of leans more heavily towards it. The other two, for sure, just kind of, in that in the same valley, but not, but it, which is not an uncanny valley. But well, I don't know. Some of it can be uncanny valley, depending. So let's go ahead and just roll right into these. Which one would you like to touch base on first?
Well, I think it might be most fun to start with a movie that you hadn't seen before, and also one that I think probably the least people have watched, which is 2014's Spring. And I would describe this movie as a romantic monster movie, if you can put those adjectives in there.
I would agree with that. Like this one of all three of them kind of I think borders most on some of the tropes that you would see in like a classic romance movie as far as like the setting and the setup for it and everything. And this one, if you did want to watch it with along with us to our discussion, you can stream this right now, I think, on Shudder and also AMC Plus.
It has been on Shudder a little bit too. This one is kind of an unusual one in the genre because it's more boy meets ghoul in the direct sense, where you have the female monster, I would say, in this. This movie is written and directed by the filmmaking duo of Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead, who, have you seen any of their films?
I have not, no.
Oh, they're all great. I love everything I've seen from them. They've done Resolution, The Endless, and they're also worked pretty heavily on some episodes of the Loki TV show
Oh,
and
cool.
Moon Knight, and they're doing some work on the new Daredevil series that's coming
Oh,
out.
good for them getting that Marvel
So,
money.
yeah, they're about to get some Marvel money, and I'm really pleased for them because they had been doing a lot of indie films before this. Of course, this one too. But yeah.
Well, and from our trusted source, IMDb, the synopsis for this one, a young man in a personal tailspin flees from US to Italy, where he sparks up a romance with a woman harboring a dark, primordial secret.
Yep. I mean, that's actually fairly good for IMDb. Good job. Pretty accurate.
They do good sometimes. And then we've got Lou Taylor Pucci as Evan and Nadia Hilker as Louise, which are really outside of maybe like one other person, these are the like a couple other people, these are the two characters that we are with the entirety of the movie.
Yeah, there are a few minor characters, but none of them have very large roles, honestly, beyond the thing. And both of these actors are kind of more indie actors. Neither of them have done a whole lot. I will say that like Lou Taylor Pucci has done 2013's Evil Dead. He played one of the leads in that. He was also in a film called Ava's Possessions, which is a great, weird film about demonic possession, and an older film called Carriers that's been out for a while.
Yeah, that like I had like when I saw him show up, like first of all, I've seen a lot of what he's been in, so I was shocked that I had not seen this one before. And I was like, okay, this kind of sets the tone for it. And overall, like, and I mean this in like the most positive and good way, this is a very indie feeling film. Like the way that it's shot, the way that it's structured, it just kind of has that kind of sheen to it.
It definitely feels like the way it starts off and all these things start going, it feels like a very like indie romantic movie because it's not like there's some comedy in it, but it's a lot of the cinematography is very soft in places, like soft lighting, all of this sort of like, oh, these two characters are going to fall in love and it's going to be kind of like a little dramatic. But then it takes that turn and you're like, oh, what am I watching? Okay,
Yeah,
which I
because like the
appreciate.
yeah the setup is like it's classic like indie romance. Like we've got like a tragedy up top, and then we've got fleeing to a picturesque, you know, scene and meeting a beautiful woman. Like it's got all of the ingredients that you're like, okay, I know what I'm in for. And kind of to a certain degree, when you take kind of the monstrous elements out of it, it still fits that formula really, really
It
well.
really does. It is a very like skillful romantic movie, I would say, because again, it has all these kind of very tropey elements that they put together, because the story starts off with a death. That Evan's mother has passed away, and this has really greatly affected him. And then he ends up getting in a bar fight afterwards, which isn't really his fault either. Like
It isn't. No, not at all.
it goes to pains to show that he's not like an inherently violent person, but this happens when you're leave your mother's funeral and these sorts of things, you know. And so he's very worried about getting sent to jail or having charges pressed against him. So he just
So he
leaves the
flees the
country.
country.
He flees the country and ends up in Italy. And I think that's where all of this was shot, was on location, which is well, maybe not. Actually, I don't think it was, but it is definitely, it feels like it was in a lot of ways.
Yeah, the other thing I really liked about this one is that I love a movie that is a good slow burn of a film, and this definitely is that. Like it kind of builds on itself a little bit. I would be lying if I said that I didn't like I was watching this late at night, and I kind of and I mean this as a positive, like I nodded off a couple of times just because of like the slow burn and the tone of it, like in a good way. And like, and you can guess at what parts woke me back up. And I would have to like go back and watch what led up to that, but not to ruin too much of it. But there were definitely things that like jarred me awake. So.
It's a melancholy movie. And I think that there's a lot of that in all the pacing and the way the characters interact to each other. And I really like that a lot because this is really like this is a Lovecraftian film, like I would say. From kind of the structure, the way it's paced to the story, it feels very cosmic horror-y and body horror at the same time. And you don't get a whole lot of why. Why are things happening? That's not as important as the things happening. But it also takes some of the horrible thing will drive you mad out of it and just kind of focuses on the characters in the story.
Also, I love a movie that has some really good pseudoscience in it, and this
Oh
definitely
yeah.
delivers on that.
100%. There's a lot of like moments where you're just like, wait, what? That doesn't work. But okay, carry on. I'm rolling with it. We're rolling with it. Because the our main character, that our guy, Evan, is definitely kind of like blue collar working class. And when he meets his new lady love,
Louise.
Luis, she is a biologist and like studying, like she's definitely trying, I think she's trying to get her PhD at the time in
She
that.
is living as a student in this time period, yes.
But she definitely has a background in like science, and when it does come up, it's sort of fascinating to be like, oh, okay, that's how you're explaining that, sure. But yeah, the pseudoscience is even more fun for me anyway.
Yeah, and I really like a film that does like to tie in some sort of historical elements to it as well, or historical event. And this one like wraps it up very nicely at the end.
Yeah, it definitely does. And I will say that, like, I think this film, for being a love story about like boy meets monster, she's really an interesting kind of monster too, because at first you don't see that. And then that's where you start to see the body horror elements start to come in a little bit more. And the way that she lets that show is kind of interesting because you as the audience are not quite sure how much trouble Evan is in as he starts to date her. It's like, wait, what is she gonna eat him? She's gonna eat him. And that is a very nice, I think, subversion because she's not really a because she's not looking to like for a meal out of him, but there is definitely something she wants from him.
Yeah, and I mean that's apparent from like their first interaction because that like you had kind of given me a little bit of a primer on what to expect with this one, but she immediately like when she first meets him is like let's go have the sex, and I think that that's one of the things I really like about her character is that like even granted she's had a lot of time to kind of figure out what to do in these situations, but she is so matter of fact about everything, not just with like her transformation but also just the way that she breaks everything down for him, which I enjoy because like obviously like Evan is such a romantic. Like he gives into it immediately like when he first meets her. And like I love that she just keeps trying to bring him back down to reality as monstrous as it is.
He doesn't want to like, because when he meets her, he's like, I'm gonna have this romance with her. And it isn't like a, hot girl. It's really like a, oh my God, she's just so mysterious. And he's just really drawn to her. And like you said, he's a
She is
romantic.
gorgeous, though. She is gorgeous.
She is gorgeous, but he's not even like, he's not into her entirely because she's gorgeous. He's just like, oh wow, you're just so amazing. Like every time he meets her, he's like, oh yeah, we should, we should go out. And like she does finally agree to go out with him. They go out a few times, and he is like all in, like all cards on the table, no, nothing. And she's just like, no, this isn't serious. Like I want you to know this isn't serious. And her straightforwardness through the whole thing makes you recognize that she's not even pretending to seduce him for this. She
No.
is putting all her cards on the table, and he's saying, no, I think we should be more.
I can fix her.
This 100% is that I can fix her.
It really
And
is.
like it works, because if the crux of this film is, of course, that like Louise is not like she's a mutant. She's some sort of like chimeric being, I would say, where and she's about 2,000 years old. She was born in Pompeii, and her body, like every 20 years, starts to transform itself. She loses like the ability to maintain human form and starts to shift into like this furred, monstrous tentacle creature where she starts to become more of a primordial being and until she gets pregnant, and then she, the embryo, she like, I don't want to say absorbs, but it's a kind of weird process where
She becomes her own daughter,
she
essentially.
becomes her own daughter every time. So she becomes a different person, but she's still her. I think part of that is that the idea is that you will get to stay forever and see the world and see all these things and be this person. The downsides is that, and this is the crux of the transformation, is that if she ever falls in love, then she remains as she is and becomes mortal.
Yeah, if there's enough
So
oxytocin
yeah,
to like
something to describe it.
to tip it over the edge, that yeah, that then she will not, the cells will just continue, like she will stay pregnant. So yeah.
So, and that's the thing though, is where she has that kind of idea of, well, I have no desire to be in love. Like it's never something that has appealed to her. It's never something that she's wanted to do. And she talks about all these great romances that she's had through the years and all these people that she's been with and been their muse, because there's all this art that features her in it. But yeah, what is it about like Evan that she just sort of chooses this? Sort of chooses this. I mean, I'm gonna go, the film leads you to believe that she chooses not to be in love. And in the end, like while they're waiting, because she says, like, I get very volatile towards the end when I'm pregnant. I'm pregnant now. Because she used him to get pregnant, and then she tells him that they're done. He does not accept it. And he doesn't accept it in a way that's like, hey, if you tell me to leave because you don't feel anything, I'm going to leave. But if you tell me to leave because you're trying to protect me, I don't want to be part of that. And then he ends up spending her last night as her together. So it's like this whole idea of like, what does that, how do you make that choice?
Yeah. Well, and okay, so what are your feelings on it? Like kind of stepping outside of it, like between like love and immortality. I mean, again, as somebody who loves love, like I like the idea of immortality, of possible immortality, if for no other reason, just to like travel and learn as much as I can.
But with everyone around you and everyone that you care about is gone, are you gonna love it as much?
That's the thing.
That is
That's
the
the thing.
thing.
That's the thing. Yeah.
And I think like the crux of this particular film is that this kind of idea that fundamentally like love changes you. You know, love makes us a little more human in a way. And that's sort of what I think the filmmakers were getting at this is not that like you're not a monster without love, because Louise doesn't spend most of her time as a monster. She just sort of transforms into this when she can no longer control her, you know, cellular stability towards the end of every 20 years. But she, like, it's the idea of like when you are in love, it does like change you on a fundamental level that, and choosing it can make you feel, you know, human.
Gross.
I know. I know.
Being human is gross. In researching some stuff, like connected to this film, I actually found a lot of comparisons to it, to the idea of like the cycle of menstruation. And I had not considered that at all, but I was like, oh, that is an interesting way to kind of view what's happening. So, what are your thoughts on that?
So like the I mean I hadn't thought about that either, and I think that you're there's a lot that's really something to unpack. I have like No, I think that that's a really interesting theory that goes with it, because there is this sort of like idea of like I have to get myself pregnant so that I can become the embryo and continue on. And you are your own, you become your own legacy in a way. But also there's the idea of pregnancy, which is its own
It's its own
sense
horror,
of it. Like,
yeah.
yeah, there are a lot of like there's a reason there's so much body horror made about pregnancy, because in a way that there is something like growing inside of you. And the fact that that is tied to her being able to stay who she is at the beginning of the film, that she has to keep getting pregnant and keep getting pregnant, and that it's tied to that is kind of like disconcerting in a lot of ways. That yeah, this fundamental process is, you know, of life is what she needs to continue to give her life,
Yeah, and
but in like a real weird way.
some of the people who were discussing it in that context, as far as like its comparison to like the cycle of menstruation, also like wanted to put it into the subgenre of uterus horror, with like other films like Carrie or Ginger Snaps or Jennifer's Body, and like I was like I could kind of see some sort of connective thread there, but not like with those other three, definitely, but I was like, I don't see how this felt would fit into that at
No,
all.
I don't think it that doesn't work for me on the same level as a lot of other films work for me on pregnancy horror and uterine horror and the idea of menstruation and womanhood being linked to horror. Because in this case, the embryo that like that, you know, that she conceives is such a minor little detail. It's not really the focus of any of the film at all, other than the fact that like, oh yeah, I do this every 20 years. And you know, but she never doesn't really give birth to herself, or at least it's not presented that way. Like she does in a way that like she has this big transformation where she goes through all the primordial forms and these tentacled and furred and reptile creatures and all this stuff. But so she does like have this painful moment every 20 years of like birthing herself that way. But that's never really the crux of the story. And it feels like such a minor thing. Like, well, how does she transform over 20 years? Well, she, you know, gets pregnant.
And that was what was interesting to me is that, I mean, obviously I'm coming at this from a male perspective, and what I was reading was being presented by somebody who was looking at it from a female perspective. But it, like you just said, like to me, the whole pregnancy and aspect of womanhood, that part of it is kind of, it's just to drive the story along, and it's just kind of part of the process. Like I don't, that's not really the focus for me.
She doesn't seem to be at all distressed by it.
No.
Like, she isn't distressed by it. She doesn't seem to find it even weird anymore.
That's the thing. She's
And
had 2,000 years to come to terms with this. Quite frankly, she is like, this is old hat for her.
yeah, and it's also like this isn't And even Evan isn't upset that she got pregnant, and then he's like, oh, well, you're taking away my chance to be a father. Like, none of that even like really comes up. Like, he's just really focused on like, but
I want
what
to
if
be with
he's,
you.
I want to be with you. What if you stayed and we were together? Like, you know, that's the whole thing of his arguments. So I don't view it in that same the same context as I would have a lot of other films that do kind of handle that, because there's nothing really to tackle about it. Like it's just
No.
part of her. The body horror is more about your body going through these transformations, which you could argue is still pregnancy horror, is this that kind of thing too, or menstruation horror. But this is more about like her choices and her being this creature and also being, you know, herself. So no, I'd have to read the article to be able to tell you, but right now, like, and I think it's a valid interpretation if that's the way you're looking through the lens of it, but it's not one that I think I can really roll with.
Okay, good. Like I
Yeah.
again, I just really wanted to get your perspective as a woman since I did not feel that it was entirely my space to speak on
No,
that. So
and honestly, without reading the article, like maybe there's a really good argument there that I haven't thought of, which is fine, there might be. But no, I really viewed this more as a transformation story about the nature of love and how that it can make us choose things for ourselves we might not otherwise choose. And whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, the movie doesn't even tell you like how this story ends up really at the end. But that's not important.
it's the journey. But
Yeah. Ha ha.
it really is.
It
It
really is, yeah.
literally is the journey.
Yeah, I definitely like see this movie as kind of a love story. I don't know, it is, like, you know, but it's got this kind of the more rare lady monsters in it. Instead of it's a man changing for love, it's a woman doing it. And I think you can look at it as sort of like her choice is either to continue to be childless and on her own, or choosing to possibly have the child that she has conceived and being with someone else. But I mean, those are choices like all women have to make a lot of times. And so that makes sense to me, I think, in that context, yes. But the film doesn't even make it as in like an either or. It's like, do you choosing to be mortal and feel things rather than like choosing a family? That's not, you know, the film doesn't present it that way.
No,
The film
not at
far
all.
more presents it more as like you can choose to be mortal and to allow yourself to feel things and feel about people, or you can be alone and continue your journey and your life there.
Yeah, I'm glad you picked this one. I think it was a really good fit for what we're discussing and what we will discuss. And also, it's always good to, I always enjoy seeing a new film that I've not seen before.
Yeah, this film is a very quiet film, like you said, it's a very slow burn. But I really like it. I have watched it a couple times and I still just really enjoy it for what it is.
I will definitely revisit it for sure.
And I think if you like a little bit of body horror, you like a little bit of romance, and you like some Lovecraftian cosmic horror elements in there for good nature, you'll probably enjoy this one.
It checks all the boxes for
It
you.
does. It does.
Well, let's go ahead and roll on to our next movie.
Okay.
So, coming in next, we have Warm Bodies from 2013.
Oh yes, the romantic.
Zom rom-com.
Yeah. Oh yes, the Zom rom-com or romantic zombie comedy, written and directed by Jonathan Levine, based on a book of the same name by Isaac Marion. Marion.
Yes, and for those who have not seen this one from our trusted source, IMDb, after a highly unusual zombie saves a still living girl from an attack, the two form a relationship that sets in motion events that might transform the entire lifeless world.
Right, you knew we couldn't talk about boy meets ghoul without, of course, having ghouls.
And let's just say, let's go ahead and say it. This is Romeo and Juliet.
Yes,
That is what this movie is.
Romeo and Juliet, except one of them's already dead at the beginning.
Oh,
So they
but
bypass that part entirely.
it's like a reverse Romeo and Juliet. They're,
Yeah, it is. It is a reverse Romeo and Juliet film. And this was like a really fun like little indie movie that came out in like the mid-aughts that way. And then it stars Nicholas Hoult, who is a delight in everything that he's ever been in.
Oh, yeah. And he is especially, for being a zombie, he's especially dreamy in this movie.
Yeah, really. Nicholas Hoult was in Renfield. as the titular Renfield. He's an X-Men First Class, as much as I dislike that film. He plays Beast in that one.
He likes being a monster.
He really does. Like, I think he takes a lot of joy into being those roles. And, you know, good for him, right? It's one of those good for him. He's also in, I think, my favorite thing he's ever been in so far is the TV show The Great. Have you seen it?
Oh my God. I am very sad that they canceled that.
It's
Like
so good. It's so good. Yeah, where he,
him and the Superior Fanning. Yes.
yeah, where he and Elle Fanning play Catherine the Great and her husband Peter.
Also, it has Teresa Palmer as
Yeah.
Julie, and
Yes.
I it had been a while since I'd seen this one, and since the last time I'd seen it, I had watched what is it, A Discovery of Witches, and I was like, oh yeah, I recognize her.
She's like an actress that I hadn't seen anything with for a while, but I remember that I liked her. You know, it's one of those things where I'm like, oh yeah, you were fun, because she's in like The Grudge 2, which I had watched recently again. And then she's in gosh, what a couple movies that she's in that are fun, kind of that in that era. Oh, she was in IO Number 4, which was that ill-fated film based off of a young adult novel. That was one of the big young adult novels in the era.
It's one of the few YA movies that I never saw. Like I love a good YA film, so.
Yeah, I saw that one. It was fine, but she wasn't the problem in it. Like, it was just overall, you know.
I would also be remiss if I did not mention that Jonathan Levine also did All the Boys Love Mandy Lane, which
That's
is
right.
a fantastic movie.
It really is. That one's a really, that movie was. Took forever to get released, and I still to this day I think a lot of people haven't seen it because of its like weird release thing. But yes, that is a really good movie. This movie also has Rob Corddry in it, who plays M, which is another zombie, and
Which is
the
our Mercutio character.
yes, our Mercutio character. And then of course we have John Malkovich as Julie's father, Colonel Grigio, I think. Grigio, I don't know, that's how you say it.
He's always a joy in every film that he is in.
Yeah, like I think my notes are, is like, this is Julie's dad and he hates everything.
Yeah.
Well, like the point is that he kind of rules this quarantine zone city at, and it's about 7 years after the apocalypse. So he has been fighting the infected for that long, and including Julie's own mother, who was infected, and they had to basically, like, I don't know how to say, put her down. Is that like, I don't know how you describe killing a zombie. But yes, but she was infected. So since then he's been very, like, very militant about everything.
Yeah. And I know that like some folks had a problem with this film as far as kind of how it was a little loose with some of the typical rules of a zombie film and like how zombies work. And I like that to balance out kind of taking away some of the more grotesque and scary nature of the zombies, they created the bonies to
Yes.
kind of amp up like the horror element of it.
Yeah, so you have zombies and in this, and zombies are kind of like, it's kind of interesting the way they're depicted because of course zombies don't talk, so a lot of this is inner dialogue that our main character R is like God going on in his head, where he just kind of talks about they live in an airport, they walk around, they sort of communicate to each other with sort of meh noises, and like, but they sort of do a lot of the same things they did in life. And in this sort of
There's
in
a
the
really good there's a really good part in the beginning whenever he's talking about the world before and about how things were so different. And I love that it was an intentional choice that it is a shot of people all walking around like on their cell phones, not disregarding one another, essentially already being zombies.
Yeah, that was, it looks a funny little scene. So these zombies have like a community in this airport where they all congregate and all do what they had in life, and then they'll go out and hunt the living because they're hungry.
And I like that
And
R has this little like his little getaway where he's like collected like his collection of different items from whenever they go out on their
right.
hunts.
Because he is an unusual zombie, even for zombies, that he has this sort of airplane that he has turned into his like little house, and all of his records and all of his like toys and gadgets and things that he's found that I don't even know that he remembers what they do, just that they exist and he liked them. Yeah. And then of course you said the bonies, which are the zombies that have given up entirely on humanity, and they have become these like almost they have become these like creatures that are devoid of expression and largely skin in places and just
They're
seem
just hunger.
yes.
They're like living hunger at that
Yeah,
point.
they're living embodiment of hunger, and even the other zombies are like, we leave them alone. We just they don't bother us, and we don't bother them, but no part of that.
Going back to you talking about like the items that he had in the plane, like you mentioned music, and that's one thing I do. Like as we've talked about before, like music is such a huge thing for me, and this movie has a killer soundtrack.
It does. It does. Like as someone who is not as music focused as you, I was like, oh, this has got some good music in it.
It's got some really good indie fare on it and some classics. And also in looking into this one, so Isaac Marion, who wrote the book, is also a musician and in 2007 released a solo album under the name Isaac Marion's Moon Colony called Dead Children, and he considers it a companion piece to this movie.
Oh, okay. Well, that's fun.
I gave it a listen and it's not bad. It's like light indie folk type rock fare. Yeah, it has its place. I was like, oh, I'm not entirely mad at this. And I could kind of see like and listen like the songs that I was able to listen to, I could see how they would match up with the movie. So I think it's really interesting that it's such a huge thing for him in the context of this movie. And also like Jonathan Levine, also music is a huge thing for him and his films too. I was reading that he talked about how going into it, there were certain songs that he knew. He's like, I want this song for this scene. But he was talking about how in the context of making movies, you have your budget set aside for like, this is my budget to purchase the like rights for these songs. And as you get further and further into filmmaking and things start eating up more and more of your budget, you have to like dip into that. So you're not able to get everything you want. But apparently Summit in this particular sense, they earmarked, they're like this bucket of money is just for music. So he was essentially able to get almost everything he wanted for the film.
Nice.
He didn't have to compromise at all.
That's very unusual.
Yeah, it did not have to compromise in
Yeah, just
filmmaking
on music, for
for
sure. Yeah, so this movie is definitely, like, as you said, Romeo and Juliet with zombies. And down to the point where R and Julie's first meeting, he sort of eats her boyfriend's brain.
Yeah.
And that starts to give him memories. And it's unclear whether or not that happens before and then, but it doesn't seem to. That the eating the brain shows him some pieces of her, like, dead boyfriend.
I think he makes a mention about like that's part of one of the reasons why they are so obsessed with like getting a living brain is that if it's still living, they do get to experience those aspects of it. Like if it's a fresh brain.
Yeah, so he sees that, but at the same time, he also sees her. And it's the sight of her while eating her boyfriend's brain that he's just like, oh wow, her. And it really is like Romeo there, just like, who is that girl that I was in love with before? I don't care about her. All Julie all the time.
There's even like there's even the balcony scene
Oh
is
my
in this
God, there
film too.
is. There's the
Yeah.
balcony scene. There's so much in this that just is so funny. And the humor is very deadpan humor, I will say. It's not like laugh out loud slapstick stuff happening in this comedy. It's very snarky, very deadpan, very just sort of like ridiculous. It's all just ridiculous. Yeah, so he rescues her from getting eaten by his friends by smearing zombie blood on her. And she's so confused. That's what I love. Like Julie spends the first like 40 minutes of this movie just so confused about what is
She
happening
rolls
the
with
whole
it
time.
very, very well
She
for the most
does.
part.
She's just like, oh, okay, I'm getting holding hands with a zombie as he takes me home. And then from there they have their little like further meet cute where he protects her from other zombies and it's very cute. And then she goes home because she, she's the living, she can't stay there. But then it sort of incites this like bigger issue with the bonies. And so R's like, well, I guess I have to go help.
Yeah,
And
it kind of it creates this spark that
yeah.
starts to spread amongst the other the entirety of the zombie community, which
Yeah.
does bring things with the bonies to a head. And there are times where like if you Again, I can see where some of the criticisms people had with this movie, maybe thinking it was a little too precious in the way that it presents things, but like I didn't feel that way about it at all. And actually, Teresa Palmer had a really good quote that I pulled for this, talking about context of like how the zombies work in this and how the change happens. She said, "For me, the core of the story is that love breathes life back into people. The human connection saves us. People who have had those lights dimmed inside them, when they fall in love, they get brighter."
That's a good quote. I like that. And it does sort of sum up this film is that R feels something and he hasn't felt anything in a really long time because he's dead. And in this context, I think we have to accept that the zombies are not your classic zombies either.
No.
They are focused on a different thing. I believe this is explored in more detail in the book where it talks about what sparked this kind of zombie plague. But it kind of gives you hints of it here where the plague was started by loneliness and uncaring and kind of jump from person to person that way, more than just I was, it was not just like a,
A viral thing, or
it didn't spread through like a biological process as much as it spread through more of like a, almost a spiritual one is what kind of the context I feel from what we're shown in the movie.
I
And I
don't want to
haven't,
say epidemic of loneliness because that term gets thrown around a lot these
but just an epidemic of indifference, maybe, because that's more what it is when you sort of stop caring. And in that context, I think the film does something kind of fresh with zombies, which is always really nice to see. I do really like seeing those things where you have this idea that, okay, we've seen so many takes on zombies. We've seen so many takes on them. So let's do something slightly different. But it works. It maybe wasn't what a lot of big zombie people, because this is in the middle of like everything was zombies. There was a while where like everything was zombies in like the 2000s there and into the 2010 like 10s slightly, where we as a culture were just zombie, zombie, zombie. And it was a lot of the same story over and over again, which by the way, I've watched them all. Like I will watch any zombie movie ever. I'm that person. But having a zombie that is not necessarily undead in the same way was unique.
Oh yeah, like I'm okay like having a fresh take that like bends the rules a little bit, especially if you're able to present a fun, compelling story like this one. And again, like Nicholas Hoult is a hot zombie in it, and it's like Jonathan Levine actually on the, like there's a quote I pulled from him for like making a sexy zombie. And he said specifically, like, we did references for them. We looked at images from the Depression. And for Nick Zombie, we gravitated towards punk rockers, especially Sid Vicious, who is a pretty dirty, scummy guy, but also has degrees of sexy danger about him. And I was like, I can't see that. I can see that. Because in the book, I believe R is, they describe him in like a suit and tie because he's like a quote unquote corporate zombie.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense of doing the corporate zombie versus this sort of younger, quote unquote, like zombie that they use for him. And but it's also that like as he becomes more enamored with Julie and goes through all these lengths to try to save her because the bonies are coming for them, he becomes slightly more human looking and like slightly more human looking. And then there's the nice, they have a nice long shower scene of him, just him in the shower. And you're just like, all right, I know what kind of movie this is.
This is made for a specific audience, and I am that audience.
But there is that sort of transformation that he starts going through. And then of course the girls put makeup on him so he can look like he can like blend in a little bit, sort of, kind
It
of.
looks so bad that like
It
I love that.
does.
Like they do, I think the makeup team in this did a really good job of like, because it is very subtle differences the more and more human he becomes, but that whenever they feel like they need to make him look the most human, that is very funny because it is the most unnatural looking thing ever.
Well, and he does a great job with like his mannerisms too, of being not quite human in the way he moves. And he's eventually able to speak the more time he spends with Julie. He's able to speak to her a little bit better. And that is unusual. And then that again branches into like M and a few other of the zombie horde that decides that they also will help against the bonies. I just love the way they're called bonies. It sounds just silly name.
It is. It does not strike fear at all.
No.
No.
Because they're all like elongated and very like skeletal creatures.
No eyes. Like, yeah, just, yeah, like you said, no eyes, no features, nothing. Just
Yeah, they're
the
just.
living embodiment of hunger.
So they're like quite fun in that respect too, because they're just like, we're gonna go murder all the humans now. Bye. And it's like, wait, what? Oh, you guys can talk to each other. I didn't know that was a thing, but okay, sure. And then of course, like her father like loses his mind over his daughter with a zombie, even though it's a talking zombie that is like clearly not ravenous. But then they, they have their, that's where you think you get some of the horror elements in this part of the movie, where you get the bonies attacking humans and then the big battle that happens. And I do think that that's like kind of fun, but this is far more of like an action adventure movie in a lot of places with the way that it's the cinematography is filmed
Yes.
than something very horrific. Because I think the horror elements kind of come in with the idea that people give up, and that's when you lose your humanity. Because there's definitely some stuff with Julie talking to R and some of the stuff that R sees in her boyfriend's memories, like dead boyfriend's memories, who is played by the little Franco, by the way.
The best Franco.
Where he sort of was losing his humanity just being a survivor. And you get a lot of those elements, I think, kind of bleed through textually of him getting reckless, like in that last battle, and sort of becoming someone that she didn't know, because living like this was stripping people of being human themselves. And that
Well, her
sort
dad is
of
a good example of that. Yeah. But I mean, yeah, because I mean, like you said, he hates everything because like he's been put in this position. They had to put down her mom. So there are ways to lose your humanity without being undead.
Well, that also makes you wonder about her mom. Like, how did they lose her? Because if she was safe kind of in this quarantine zone, how do you get infected there? So that might be a little part of it too, is that part of the infection that happened to her mother? Because it certainly seemed to be happening to her boyfriend before he got so, like, because she even says, like, she has a line where she's just like something about how she thought it was going to happen sooner or later because he was getting so reckless and didn't seem to be holding his own life that valuable anymore. So it's kind of, there's a lot of those little elements of like storytelling in the movie that I really liked, especially when I just watched it again recently for this episode. I was like, oh yeah, there's a lot of little things in there that I don't think you catch the first viewing.
Did you see this movie when it originally came out?
I did. I went to the theater to see this movie.
I did too. And something that I had not considered, but in reading stuff for this episode, was that it apparently some of the negative reviews that it got were comparing it to Twilight, and I just don't understand that at all.
That is a weird one, because, I would not have ever compared it to Twilight. I don't think it has even the same framework. I would far more compare it to Shaun of the Dead than I would with Twilight.
Yeah,
You know,
yeah.
like it's
But
it
they're
has.
much more companion pieces to one another.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
don't think that this movie, and I know some people, there's been some criticism of it being more of a, oh, they were ripping off Shaun of the Dead by trying to make a comedy. And I was like, no, this feels like an homage a little bit to some Shaun of the Dead elements. And like you said, a companion to it. Because part of the thing with Shaun of the Dead is, again, at the end of the movie, Shaun has started living and actually not being stuck in the rut moving forward. And in this film, you get that same sort of ending. Whereas the DNA of Twilight is completely different.
Yeah,
And
they're essentially it, like people. I mean, I was like, okay, you've got a romance between two young people, and one of them is undead. That's about where the similarities end. But Jonathan Levine was talking about, like, I read some stuff with him, where he was saying that he was adamant when people would say those things to like be like, no, but then also still stick up for Twilight because Twilight, through the lens of time, we have all learned that Twilight is not terrible.
Well, it's one of those things where Twilight was judged very harshly when it came out because it was a thing that younger women were into. And
Yeah.
as we know, young women can't be into anything. Like
Oh no, it's terrible.
I was never a Twilight girly, and I had a lot of friends who were, and that's fine. I read the first book or two, and then was just like, you know what? Like, this doesn't really hold my attention. I'm not really that into it. But people were. And it was
I
just
read all
because
four books.
did you? I've seen all the movies, but I
I
haven't
read
read all
all
the
four books
books.
after the fact. Like I was a late convert to Twilight.
Ah.
Like the movie, like I'd heard about it, and then the movie came out and I saw the trailer for it, and I was like, that looks ridiculous. And then I had friends who were very, very into it. And so I finally watched it when it hit like DVD. And I was into it for how ridiculous it was. I was like, I am in. And I immediately read all four books within a month and then saw every other movie at a midnight show.
There's a lot in Twilight you can criticize, and I'm not saying it's above reproach, but it was judged far more harshly than, let's say, Ready Player One,
And
which was marketed towards boys and was equally as ridiculous.
I know you
But
have thoughts on that too,
I do,
so.
and like, you know, this really, we're talking about monsters today, not nostalgia bait. But I do think that, like, but it was judged far more harshly than a book that was written for boys that has equally ridiculous elements in it. And I think that's kind of really telling about the way we view media marketed towards certain people.
Yeah, look at how people are like twisting themselves up over Taylor Swift being at football games. I think that's a good example of it.
Yeah, that's
So.
true. That's true. No, nobody cares. Just let the girl go to a football game. I don't care. So you're gonna get more Swifties watching football now? Okay, great. They're gonna be fans of your team. Why are you upset?
Yeah.
Yeah, Twilight is another one of those, like, romancing the monster films, except it is vampires, which are, you know, often the monster of choice for a lot of people. But zombies are a little different, and I like to see it. I like to
I
see it.
do.
Movies,
I enjoy a good sexy zombie, and this delivered.
yeah, and it is definitely, I think, the most, like, heteronormative of the films that we're gonna talk about in a way that's, like, I definitely geared towards this film is probably geared a little more towards women in the love story, and that's not a bad thing, and this is not a criticism. I love to see it that you start to put more horror elements into movies that you want to market towards women. Please do. Like, there's nothing wrong with that, but I do think it appeals to a lot of people. It's a fun movie.
Oh yeah, I think it has a little bit of like, I mean, I know it's cliche, but it has a little bit of something for everyone, for
Yeah,
sure.
it really does.
What is your favorite sexiest zombie?
My
Like taking R out of the mix, which I know is probably is was not yours to begin with, but what is your favorite sexy zombie?
It's like sexiest zombie in any media.
In
Oh.
any media, yeah. You
Okay.
know what mine is.
Actually, I don't.
It's Return of the Living Dead 3.
Oh, no, yeah, duh, sorry. She's yes. Okay. Yes, that is a good one. But I think the one that has, like, always also a Julie in that movie, Return of the Living Dead 3. It's a great, that's another great boy falls in love with ghoul, except that they're already in love. But sure, yeah. My favorite sexiest zombie. Okay. Have you ever seen Cemetery Man?
I have not, I know of it.
It's Della Morte, Della More is the other name, and it's like an Italian film. And there is a zombie in it, and her name is She. And no, that's it for me, was her. I saw that one before I saw Night of the Living Dead 3, and I was just
Show me
like,
a picture. Show
okay,
me a
all right.
picture.
Find you this picture. Oh man, you're not ready for this. Maybe you are. Where's the chat? Chat? Here you go. I don't know if this movie was ever put on DVD or anything. It's from the 90s, the early 90s.
That checks out.
Yeah.
Very, very ethereal and otherworldly. Yeah, I can see that.
She's sort of like, she's got her, like, death shroud on. Yeah, go tell me what you're seeing there.
So very, I would say, ancient inspired garb, you know, very flowy, almost, yeah, shroudy, to toga-esque. We've got some wonderful vines and greenery on the body and in the hair, and that is quite the smolder for a zombie.
Well, let me show you a picture of her, the living version of this actress too, 'cause yeah. This film stars Rupert Everett, who I was just always loved too and things.
Oh wow. Yeah, she's
Yeah.
beautiful.
Yeah, she's beautiful. The actress is beautiful. So yeah, that was probably what I would consider the, like, sexiest zombie.
And of course we will post these photos. Yes,
Yeah.
yes.
You can see it. So yeah, I think Julie from Return of the Living Dead 3 is also a great pick because she really has that, like, punk aesthetic too. That's really fun. And she has all of the sharp objects pressed into her because, of course, pain keeps you,
The hunger at bay.
keeps the hunger at bay. Yeah, I think definitely that's
Yeah,
the
I love
one
that movie.
mine.
I just love that movie, period.
It is a really great, because we almost talked about that one. That was one of the almost one on our list, because it is one of those films that is slightly campy in a different way from the other Return of the Living Dead movies. And I
I think I was
appreciate
the
that for
perfect
it.
age for it to like really, really impact me in a way. Yeah. Like I think like we've talked about it before, like going through the video store and, you know, spooking ourselves and scaring ourselves from like the covers of movies. And I remember seeing the cover of that one and being like, I need to watch this movie.
It's an incredibly iconic cover, I would say, of her, because it's Julie with like black. No, it's she's kind of like done in black mostly, and behind her is like a bright red, if I'm remembering correctly.
Very monochromatic, yeah.
Yeah, and then it has her kind of like with her hand up and like all of the like metal kind of shrapnel embedded in her, and you were like, "What is this?" So I'd seen the cover many years before I actually watched the film. But yeah, that was a good pick. I do appreciate your choice there. A
But
plus for
R
her.
is a close second because I just like Nicholas Holt is such a cutie.
He's very charming and yeah, very attractive. So
And if anybody wants to watch this film, it is streaming for free on Tubi.
yes, you have to watch it with ads. There are a few ads on Tubi, but it is a pretty enjoyable film. And is Return of the Living Dead 3 streaming anywhere?
Let me take a look and see.
And if you would like to watch Return of the Living Dead 3, it is currently streaming on Amazon Prime.
Oh, on Freevee. Yeah.
On Freevee as well? Okay.
Which is Amazon, which is essentially Amazon Prime with
Oh, is it?
ads.
Oh, okay. Unfortunately, I don't believe that Cemetery Man is streaming anywhere for free, but I think you can rent it on Amazon Prime, maybe. It's a fun little ridiculous movie. So now that we've covered primordial mutants and zombies, some ghoulish things, and a little bit of vampires, we have one other big subgenre to tackle, I think. And I think this is it's I don't think I'm out of line to say that this is the monster fucking movie to end all monster fucking movies. It is
I
the
would
pinnacle.
agree.
It's the pinnacle of the genre, and also largely responsible for making this more mainstream in the last 10 years. And that, of course, is The Shape of Water, the 2017 dark fantasy film from director Guillermo del Toro.
A fave.
Oh, yes. And it was written by del Toro and Vanessa Taylor. So it was a co-production between the two of them in the writing.
And our synopsis from IMDb on this one. At a top secret research facility in the 1960s, a lonely janitor forms a unique relationship with an amphibious creature that is being held in captivity.
Yes, this is one of my favorite films. I love this movie. It's probably Del Toro's best film. I don't know if it's my favorite Del Toro film, but it's probably, I think, maybe his best. I don't
What
know.
is your favorite?
Hellboy.
Oh, okay. Why did I even ask that
Why did you ask
question?
that? You
Why
know.
did I?
You
The
know what
look,
I'm
though.
about.
Listeners, the look that I just got.
It
Oh my God. That was
was
enough
my.
to like.
It's my sigh of feeling vaguely called out on the subject matter. But yes, I'm a huge Hellboy fan in terms of both the film franchise and the comics. So yeah.
Guess mine. Guess mine.
Your favorite? Is it Pan's Labyrinth?
It is Pan's Labyrinth
Because
because
that's
I like things that are sad and horror.
that makes perfect sense. No, but I think I really would say like The Shape of Water is one of his, if not his best films, in my opinion. I love this film so much. And of course, it introduced the whole world to the beauty of the asset or the gill man, as it were.
I say hot fish man.
Hot fish
That's
man.
what I,
Lo
hot fish
lots of people
man.
say hot fish man. Lots of people.
And speaking of the hot fish man, like there's a reason why this movie was so critically acclaimed and why it was nominated for so many awards for a lot of reasons, but this cast is stacked.
Oh my gosh. So, such an incredible cast all the way through.
So we have Sally Hawkins, we have Octavia Spencer, we have Michael Shannon, who we'll get into it. And Doug
Well,
Jones.
so Sally Hawkins, you can see her. She was in the Legendary's Godzilla films, And she was also in the Paddington movies, which is, delightful, I think. You have like Octavia Spencer, of course, is in A Time to Kill. She's in Ma. She is in Hidden Figures and Snowpiercer for like how to pick some of her genre films.
That is a good mix,
Yeah,
yeah.
I just wanted to kind of go across the spectrum because she's done so many
So
genres and so
much.
many things.
Shout out to Ma.
Richard Jenkins, who plays Giles, is it. I know him from 6 Feet Under. I think that's the first thing that I ever saw him in because he's the dad in 6 Feet Under from HBO. He's also in Burn After Reading, which is another thing I know him from. And then, of course, Michael Shannon, who is, Michael Shannon. I don't know.
That's all you
Or
have to say,
no,
like.
I really like it feels that way because he's in so many things, like he's in Boardwalk Empire. He was in Bullet Train, which was a really good recent movie if you haven't seen. He was in, gosh, he's in so many things. Like he debuted in like Groundhog Day, I think was his first movie. Bad Boys 2, Man of Steel. He played General Zod in those. I don't know. What do you know him from? You're kind of giving me a look like
No. I just like
I'm
that's
just
the thing. In my head, I'm like thinking like the thing that I like to say about Michael Shannon is that if you need somebody who is just scary as themselves and who needs to be imposing, he is a good pick to get them. But I think the film that I really like him in is Midnight Special. Have you ever seen that one?
Sounds really familiar.
It's sci-fi. Yeah, you should check it out.
I think
Everybody should check that movie out.
it doesn't like the name rings a bell, but I'm gonna have to like look up to see if I've seen it or not because I don't know. Saying it's sci-fi is not.
But it falls into that subgenre of Michael Shannon films where he is a concerned father, like, because there are more than one of
Yeah, there's a lot
those.
of those. There's a lot of those. And like and he is, of course, like Strickland, who's the government agent who is the villain in this movie. And of course, Doug Jones. Doug Jones, who has been literally almost every creature you know, honestly. Like this is not a hyperbole at all, because not only is he the Gill Man, he's Abe Sapien in the Hellboy franchise. He is Billy in Hocus Pocus. He is in Star Trek Discovery as the I don't remember the character's name. Do you remember the character's name? Do you watch that
I
show?
have not watched any of Star Trek Discovery.
Okay. He's in Star Trek Discovery. He is in What We Do in the Shadows,
As the
the
master.
master in the TV series. He's of course in Pan's Labyrinth, Del Toro's film. He is in Mimic, another Del Toro film. He was in the English version of REC, which is called Quarantine. He is in that film. And he always play a spindly, very creepy creature a lot of times. And he is the most delightful man. If you've ever have an opportunity to meet him, please do so. He's so delightful.
I think that's why I like his character in What We Do with the Shadows is because like I feel like that's the role where he gets to be most himself. Oh, and it's so good. It's so good. I'm so sad that that show is ending.
Yeah, but I mean, we got what we got of it, so I'm gonna be happy for
And
it.
it's good. And it's good. Yeah, better to go out on a high note for sure. Yeah.
So The Shape of Water again, stacked cast. This is the film that I think brought like a human monster love story to the big screen. I think it sparked it in popular culture, and it kind of gave a little more visibility to this genre as a whole of this romancing the monster genre. Because I mean, it's always sort of existed, but I think we've certainly gotten a big boost since the 2010s. So, and thanks in a large part to this film.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, the amount of people who were shocked, I think, to have found this creature sexy, that was really enjoyable. Because I mean, you and I are like we're monster fucking since time immemorial. But to
I know
see
what I
like,
am.
yeah, to see new converts to that, I'm like, yeah, welcome to the club of being a sicko.
Well, it is certainly like welcome to like this idea of, oh yeah, you're into this, aren't you? It's weird at first, isn't it? And that's okay. Yeah, it's gonna feel weird. It's okay to look at that look at the booty on that fish man and be like,
Well, the consideration that went into how he looked, yeah, Mike Hill, who like created the sculptural version of the asset, I've got a quote here from him. Guillermo was adamant that the creature was not a monster, but actually a handsome leading man. That was the initial design directive I got. I made some sketches of features I thought would make a man mix with a fish to look handsome. Big doe eyes, a strong jaw, the cleft chin. All the things are meant to make the face heroic and handsome. And he gave him kissable lips, which is important because like nobody wants to kiss big fishy lips, unless you do. I'm not one to kink shame. But then also, like he said, like the challenge was the butt of the creature. Apparently, like there was so much consideration given to the ass of this creature.
I that doesn't surprise me at all. Like the way that they definitely sculpted him in a way to make all that very obvious. Yeah, a lot of thought went into the creature from the sound of it, and that's not surprising. It's a Del Toro film. He is one of us, I will say.
He's got a hot bod. I love that the description, they're like, oh, we had to give him a swimmer's build. And I'm like, hold up, time out. Like, he is a amphibious fish creature. Any build he has is a swimmer's build.
Right. But the fact that they were
Specifically,
like
like, broad
tapered, the sh
shoulders.
like broad shoulders, tapered into the waist, like longer arms, which isn't a problem for Doug Jones. He is a very long-limbed individual, and kind of playing up on all that for sure, for sure. Like the creature was well designed, I will say. Well constructed. And this is another one of those like films that I think blends a lot of genres really well because it starts out as almost with some horror elements in it. Like when Eliza, our main character, meets the creature, she's alarmed but then that turns into curiosity and then a kinship very quickly. But you have this setup as if he is some sort of monster, like a scary monster at the beginning. And we kind of have that reveal that no, that's really not the case. Especially since the first time that they talk about him, it's like, someone found some fingers on the floor. And that kind of is what sparks this off, is that he bit off some fingers, which turns into a really gruesome plot point later on. But that's fine. That's fine.
Yeah, it like it starts off kind of horror, it kind of goes into like some fantasy. Like that Del Toro is so good at blending so many different things together. And like also this film just visually is just such a delight to look at.
It's a gorgeous film. It is atmospheric and a little dreamy and also scary in the way the set design works, depending on the scene and depending on what you need the scene to do. I really like that about him, is that he knows how to dress a set to convey a meaning without going too heavy into it.
Yeah. And Sally Hawkins' performance, like for a character that is mute, like is just pitch perfect. And he wrote this role specifically for her. This role and also Michael Shannon's were written specifically for those actors, which looking back on it, I'm like, that makes sense. Like like they seem very at home in those roles. And he also, this is not shocking at all, he wrote lengthy backstories for all of the major characters. Like some of them apparently ran over 40 pages long. And he present being the good guy that he is, he did present them to the actors and was like, you can take or leave what you want from these. And they responded differently. Apparently, Richard Jenkins said that he ignored most of the backstory.
That's fair. That's fair. Yeah. And like, I think it's really telling that there's no part of this movie that wasn't done purposefully. From the fact that it's set in 1962, where we are beginning this sort of like, this kind of like the communist scare, the Red Scare. So you have a very deep fear of the other coming in to this. The fact that your lead actress is mute, so she is this disabled woman in an era that is much less kind to disabled people than it is now, which is not to say that we are particularly kind to disabled people now, but you know, in an era specifically that's much worse for folks. You have Richard Jenkins playing Giles, who is the a gay man, and again, you have a lot of the what is it, the pink scare happening at the same time, you know. That sort of elements going in. He was trying to revisit his glory days as an advertising illustrator whose job is kind of being overtaken by photography at the moment. You have Octavia Spencer. I mean, she's a black woman and is often treated like much like the help in in the film. So the entire like these this cast is all very like othered already. And then you have Michael Shannon come in, and I think that's true, is like, 'cause like from the beginning Del Toro knew what he was doing, because he really like he's got this quote where he's just like, if we were doing this as a monster movie, the character of Strickland, it's Michael Shannon, would be the hero and the creature would be the monster. I wanted to reverse those things. So from the get-go, like he's subverting all of your expectations about what a monster movie is and what is the monster in this film. Because it starts out as a fairy tale and it's like, let me tell you about a princess and the love of her life and the monster that tried to tear them apart. And you think, okay, how are we going to do this then? And of course, it's Del Toro, so he's going to make exactly what he wants to make, and we're all going to be
Yeah,
happy with it.
it's masterfully done. It doesn't it's not by any stretch of the imagination groundbreaking to present well, the monster is actually us, but he does it in a way that it feels fresh and it doesn't feel like we're beat over the head with it.
So I think one of the things to say to that is the monster is us. Is the fact that he Del Toro goes to great lengths to point out that the asset, the Gill Man, is not human, and he's never going to be human, and we're reminded of that like over and over in the story. Like, trigger warning, he does eat a cat. That is a thing that happens in the film. He doesn't speak human language, and he doesn't assimilate into human culture because he is an other, and part of that is why Eliza's so drawn to him. That part of that is why she feels this great kinship to him, is because he is not the Michael Shannon who asks her creepy questions about, are you totally mute? In a very weird and creepy sexual way, because it kind of lets his sort of what he wants out of a woman shine through, which you see in his relationship with his wife. So yeah, I think you have those elements in there, and I think that is what pulls The Shape of Water apart from most of the other falling in love with monster stories, and even some of the ones we've talked about, where he doesn't become human for her.
No, yeah, no, that, because that is kind of what we see often is that. There's a change, and I yeah it there is not a change here, and actually it's kind of more like she would be more inclined to go to that world if she were able to.
Yeah, she feels more at home with him and what he is and who he is. And of course, like, oh God, she has that quote, I think, that is one of it. She's an amazing line from the film that like I love so much. And like I don't know if you know the one that I'm talking about, but where she's talking to Giles, I think, and she's basically like, when he looks at me, the way he looks at me, he does not know what I lack or how I'm incomplete. He sees me for what I am, as I am. And it's such a beautiful quote to me. I don't know. I love that line so much. And I think that's kind of sums up the crux of their relationship, is that they both see each other for what they are. She doesn't see him as an asset or an oddity or something to be studied, because that's also the thing, is they came to his home in the Amazon, dragged him out, and then basically don't know what they actually want to do with him. They and then the Russians want him because the Americans want him, and neither of them know exactly why they want him so much.
It's just so that the other can't have them.
Right. And I feel like that's such an element too, that's so purposefully dug in there, where you don't actually have any stake in this other than the fact that he is so unique, so you have to possess him. Whereas Eliza's like, no, he's not a thing. I don't know. I it's very masterfully done, I will say, in that I know we see a lot of narratives where, oh, they're not really a monster, they're just misunderstood. It's the classic Beauty and the Beast right there. But man, there's no prince underneath the
That's the
scales.
thing. It's like they're like the beast has to turn back into the prince for the story to have a happy ending and it be complete. Well, for most people, I mean, again, there are those of us that are like, he could have stayed a beast. I would have been okay with that. So, quite frankly, he was better looking as a beast.
Well, yeah, oh, 100%, 100%, he was better looking as a beast. That is, I think, always been the case. Everyone, Everyone I know believes that about, at least about the Disney film. Everyone I know believes that. But that's, I mean, that is the thing though, is that there is no, he doesn't have a magical transformation and is suddenly the scales fall away and he's a hot guy underneath. At no point, he is himself the entire time.
And still a hot guy.
And still a hot guy. Yeah. And I love that. And that was Del Toro's whole thing at the beginning, because like, when I first heard about that he was making this movie, I was just like, Del Toro, are you making an Abe Sapien fan fiction? Is this your Abe Sapien fan fiction? And because I knew at the time he had wanted to do an Abe Sapien film,
Like a
a
standalone.
standalone film, because the original Hellboy films were, there were supposed to be, he wanted to make a trilogy. He wanted to do three Hellboy films and he wanted to do an Abe Sapien film, but he couldn't get the funding for the third film. And he never got the funding. He couldn't get the rights to do the Abe Sapien character film either. So instead, he was like, okay, like, so he started to do this film. But honestly, this film bears way more in mind with the Creature from the Black Lagoon than it does Abe Sapien, to be entirely honest. And that's on purpose because Del Toro was obsessed with the Creature from the Black Lagoon when he was a kid. He has this great line where he's talking about why he wanted to do this film. And he's kind of quoted in this Hollywood Reporter article. And I love this. This is so Del Toro too. I can hear this in his voice, where he's like, "The creature was the most beautiful design I'd ever seen," he recalls. "And I saw him swimming under actress Julie Adams, and I loved that the creature was in love with her, and I felt an almost existential desire for them to end up together." Of course, that didn't happen. So young Del Toro made it happen, sketching the fish man and his love interest over and over again. Quote, "I had them eating ice cream, go on a double bicycle, having dinner," he says. So like it's Creature from the Black Lagoon fan fiction, and I love it so much.
Can I confess something to you?
Yes, please do.
So, as a child, I had a creature. I cannot remember where it came from because I don't think it was something that was purchased. I think it was something I may have gotten like at a, I don't know, at a restaurant, like as part of like a, I don't want to say a Happy Meal or something like that. I had a Creature from the Black Lagoon action figure. Like, I mean, like it was about like G.I. Joe size. I was obsessed with that thing. It squirted water. Like you would press his wonderful abs, which I was very aware that he had a good
He
like
did.
solid abs. But you would like press that underwater, and he would suck in water, and you can make him spit. But I was obsessed with that thing, and I was so unbelievably sad when something happened to it. Like
Oh.
I'm fairly certain my mother probably took it away from me. She probably recognized that there was something like really strange and unholy about like the love I had for it. But I was so sad. But yeah, like that's why I think like this appealed to me because I also kind of find the Creature from the Black Lagoon to be somewhat sexy too.
You're not the only one, and I think that's part of it. It's like I know a lot of people who are very into the Gill Man, and like I mean very into the Gill Man, and it's one of those things where you have friends and you don't know that's their thing, and then you're like, oh, and don't worry, I'm not gonna out anybody, but I know who you are and you know who you are, and I'm very happy for you and your love of this, because he is like, you know, he's kind of the most vulnerable of a lot of the original Universal monsters in a lot of ways, because they could go into his house and they attack him in his own home, you know. And there is that love story between the human guy and the girl, but it's a love story, you know, like it doesn't really do anything. There's not any spark to it. But they are invading his house, and he only like attacks back when he's attacked. You know, he's not the like mostly like the real aggressor of the
It's
film.
defensive, yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot there to be like, oh, if only the monster and the girl were able to get together, because he's so enamored of her when he's watching her swim and like all this other stuff, because she is so different and then also, you know, interesting. But then that woman, that movie has a lot more in common with like white women in peril than, which is very indicative of the times, let's be honest. Like the gotta put those the other is gonna go after the white women and it's gonna be scary, as opposed to The Shape of Water, which turns all that on its head.
Yeah. Whenever Universal decided to, they were gonna do like their dark universe, that I did.
Which
I
didn't
don't know if you.
happen.
It didn't happen. I don't know if you saw that. Apparently, in the new park, there's gonna be a whole section dedicated to that,
It's
which is.
dedicated to the classic. The new
Yeah.
Universal Park is dedicated to classic Universal monsters.
Yeah. Like whenever they were talking about that, like I was shocked that that was not one of the first things they kind of like rolled into, because I don't know, like we've seen so much Dracula, we've seen so much Wolfman, we've seen so much Frankenstein. Why would you not mind that one?
Oh yeah. Well, so the original Universal Park, Universal Studios, has had a lot of influence for the classic Universal monsters. Not to go on a segue, here we go.
I love a good tangent.
They had a like a really they have a they still have a really cool like makeup show, like horror makeup and classic monster creature stuff. There's the entire store dedicated to classic monsters. There used to be a monster cafe there that had a bunch of props from the films and things like that. And they've moved them all out now because they turned some of that into the Minions. But it's if you follow theme park news at all, like me, we knew that the Universal Monsters section was coming. And there's going to be a dark ride that takes you through Frankenstein's castle. There is also going to be a coaster, which I think we think might be werewolf related. So Wolfman, the Wolfman. So it should be a really fun section of the park. I'm very curious to know how it goes from conception to actually being put into motion, because I'm sure we're going to have a gift shop. I'm sure we're going to have an actual restaurant maybe this time, because the Monster Cafe had some barbecue stuff and it was fine, but it wasn't, the
Yeah.
best food. So I really would like to a sit down kind of restaurant place there to go to eat with monsters.
Yeah, you're served by a Dracula. Yeah.
Yes. But yeah, that's part of it is like the Universal monsters were very well loved, but also I think probably the Gill Man was maybe the sexiest of them, I would say, for the time of that iteration before some people come at me, because like I wouldn't, I mean, Bela Lugosi's Dracula is not even in my list of like top five sexy Draculas.
Oh, no, not at all. No.
As fun as that movie is, don't get me wrong. Because, and not even saying that he's not a very striking man, because he really is. But when it comes to it, I don't think he was really played as a like sex symbol in that film. And then you have like, of course, Lon Chaney was the Wolfman, and
Not a very sexy wolf man.
Frankenstein's monsters, just not.
Yeah.
So out of those classics, and I mean the mummy, it's the mummy, you can't see him.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I don't know, where do you rank those on the scale?
No, yeah, I mean, Gillman is definitely at the top of that, and I think that that
Okay.
is a really good segue to, you know who I am, you know what I am.
Yeah, I do.
So when we were talking about how sexy the acid is in the Shape of Water, I was like, well, what are some other hot aquatic creatures?
Okay.
Which
All right.
I will tell you that if you search hot aquatic creatures in Google, the results are disappointing. It really just brings back animals that live on thermal vents, because it literally brings back
Okay.
hot aquatic creatures.
Oh.
So I tried to modify my search results, and so I was like hot or sexy sea creatures. And so then that brought me to a list of the most romantic sea creatures, which
Okay.
I will let you know these. Some of these, like some of them, are like the ones you would expect. Like number one, seahorse. Those are considered to be super romantic because of how they mate. A French angelfish, because the French know the best. A mantis shrimp, because of how colorful it is. And I was like, no, still not what I'm looking for. I was
No.
like, I need to find. So again, I modified it, and I was able to find a list on Wikipedia of aquatic, pool, and ocean-based amphibious humanoids. So I was like,
Okay.
okay, I'm just going to go through this list and see what I can find for us to discuss. So of course, the asset is on there, and
Of
we've talked at
course.
length about how fuckable he is. So I wanted
Yes.
to go through some others and kind of see how you felt about their fuckability. And again, this is listeners, we will post these images for you to weigh in on as well.
Okay.
And I'm going to go in timeline order based on like
Okay.
the, and I limited myself to movies because if I opened it up to like mythology,
Oh, we'd be here all
literature,
day.
we'd be here all night. We'd be here all night. So I kept it strictly to movies and I didn't pick all of them. I decided to just get a few. So the first one I have for you is, of course, The Gill Man from Creature from the Black Lagoon. We've already talked about at length of
Talked about it.
that, 1954. So the next one we have is The Gill Man from The She Creature, 1956. Are you familiar with this? I've got pictures for you. You don't have to look anything
Give me some
up.
pictures. I've
So this one I have thoughts on, and I hope that you do too.
Okay.
So this is the creature from this one.
Oh, okay.
And I've got another one here for you too, that is a action figure that kind of shows it in color. So describe what you're seeing to the listeners.
So he's, I guess he's a sea monster because he looks a little more like a, almost like a rock monster. Like I'm getting the thing from the Fantastic Four vibes off of him with like some protrusions from his head, except he's green. So he's big and like rocky with green. His abs appear to be like a, I don't know what's going on there. Like
Pincers of some sort or something like
he's
that.
got some pincers in his like abdominal cavity. He's got a Fing Fang Foom head. I'm hoping this like helps describe it to people because like I don't really know. We're gonna put them on the no thank you list. I'm gonna say no
No,
thank
thank
you.
you.
No
Does he
thank
have any
you.
redeeming qualities at all? He's got one. He's got one I know of.
I'm trying to like he's got one that you know of.
Yeah, he's got them big old bar of titties.
Okay, yeah, I was about to say, like, he looks like a daddy. So he's definitely a daddy.
So he's a no for you. I
No?
maybe I it would be
Okay,
maybe
all
it
right,
would depend.
maybe.
Yeah, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. I've had a little bit to drink, maybe.
It's the bar of titties, isn't it? That's the
I
like the
just
name.
wanted to be smothered. The next one
Okay.
is The Gillman from The Monster of Piedras Blancas from 1958. And let me pull that one up here for you. This one we're not even gonna have to spend a whole lot of time on.
Oh no, thanks. He's very
He looks like if
he looks like
Beavis and/or Butthead were a sea creature.
so he looks a little like Bosk from like a green like the shape I think the shape of his head like Bosk from Empire Strikes Back, one of the bounty hunters, the one with the really long arms. I don't know, that might be a little too much of a deep cut for some people, but yeah, he's got like tusks and his permanent snarl. He's gray, again, gray with like a greenish kind of cast on him, it looks like. Of course, it's all in black and white, so it's kind of hard to tell. But yeah, he just kind of looks like he's wearing a spaceman suit. So,
Yeah,
nah.
that's a no. That's a no.
Yeah.
Okay. The next one up is 1980, the titular creatures from Humanoids from the Deep. I don't need
Oh,
anything.
no.
Do
Oh, no.
I?
I've seen you.
Yeah,
Get up from school.
that's a no for me, dog, too. Yeah,
That's
that's a no for
a
me.
no for okay, Humanoids of the Deep. You've seen the movie, right?
I have not. No, but
Oh my God.
I'm
Okay.
familiar with the creature design, though.
So those are the sexual assault monsters for sure. That's what the whole movie is. And they made I think two creature suits for the whole film, and there's supposed to be a bunch of them. So you're kind of seeing the same guy in a creature costume like meander around awkwardly. It sure is a Roger Corman movie. I'll tell you that right now. It sure is a Roger Corman movie. But yes.
So next up we have from 1994. Are you familiar with the Chris Elliott starring vehicle Cabin Boy?
I am familiar with that film. Yes, I know the movie.
So okay. I'm
It's
trying to
going
find,
weird places.
we've got the shark man. Feelings on him. I mean, it is literally just a man with some shark features.
No, he can stay. He can stay. Yeah, I'll the shark man was like definitely he's mermaid material, merman material really. He's also real like a buff guy and who's the actor that plays him?
It is oh man, I had that pulled up.
Oh, sorry.
Not important. We'll come back to it.
No, like he definitely is the Yeah, he's a bit of a big, beefy, bearded shark man. All
Got that
right.
salt and pepper going.
He definitely has a salt and pepper going.
Next up, 1995, we have, I don't need to show you a picture of this. You will know, oh, the Mariner from Waterworld. Technically falls into this.
Like, you're gonna bring Waterworld into this?
You're gonna hate the next one. You're gonna hate the next one if you hate this.
I'm probably gonna go with no. Like, Kevin Costner is fine in Waterworld, but like, nah, no thanks.
No, I don't find, I've never found Kevin Costner to be
He's
particularly
just
sexy,
a
so
dude. Like,
yeah.
there's not a monster. Sorry. That's a fail.
And then the last one are 1999, the Gungans from Star Wars.
I would not fuck Jar Jar Binks. So there's
I
your
would hope,
answer.
or I would, even
No.
if he didn't talk, I would not fuck Jar Jar Binks.
Okay, but like you're missing out some other like good ones. Like what about like okay, if we're gonna go even Star Wars, you're not even doing the most iconic of the sea people, the seamen from Star Wars, right?
No, but I specifically wanted to throw the Gungans in
You
there. I
really
thought it
want to
was
throw the
a...
Gungans in there. Okay, but what about Admiral Akbar? Come on.
I mean, I like a man in uniform.
He looks very good in the uniform.
He looks very good in the uniform. He does have authority and power. That's appealing as well. I mean, I might go out on a couple of dates with him. I
Okay,
don't know
you give
about
him a chance.
fuckability.
I'd give him a chance. That's fair too. That's a good one. And of course, the obvious, like King Shark, man.
My favorite thing, have you seen both of the Justice League Dark animated films?
I know exactly what you were referring to.
Oh my God, the Constantine line, the John Connor, that is the most, I love it. I love it. It's so good. For those who may not have seen it, there is a reference that John Constantine makes whenever they are in a group of people, specifically some villain characters, where he's like, oh no, my ex is over there. And they think that he is referring to Harley Quinn, when in reality, he is referring to King Shark. Because John Constantine, monster fucker.
Oh, this John Constantine's character. I mean, but yeah, like for sure, like King Shark, right? We can agree, King Shark.
Specifically, I love the version of King Shark in the Harley Quinn animated series.
Yeah, fair. Yeah, that one. And also I would take the Justice League Dark one too. Yeah. And you know the thing about sharks.
Yeah, I do. Oh no, so because then that also opens up, like, we all know my obsession with Legend of Zelda, so we've got Prince Sidon as well,
Oh
and I would be
yeah.
lying if I said I hadn't looked up fan art on that.
I don't even go here for the legend, like the Zelda thing, and I have seen fan art of that. Okay. The internet is just it like washes up the shores on my internet. It's like, oh, well that's what people are in. Okay. Oh sure, I guess.
Legend of Zelda checks so many boxes for me.
That does make sense for it really does. There's something for everybody there.
Link was the very first twink I ever had a crush on when I was a kid, so it set the
Unsurprising, unsurprising entirely.
But that's my list. That's my list for this episode.
Okay, good list, good list. Yes or no's was a lot of them on there. I'm gonna have to dig up so many pictures of things for you guys to see because oh boy, it's a selection. But yeah, I do think out of the films that we talked about in this episode, they all kind of hit slightly different niches in terms of like what you like and what you're into in terms of and there's so many other films that are about this specific topic. These are just the three that I thought were like a good primer, if you would, for anyone interested in the genre.
Yeah, and it gives you a good mix of tone, yeah, tonally as well. So I think these are some good choices. And it sets up perfectly, for what we're going to discuss in our next
That's
episode.
right. Yeah. Next time we'll talk about the origins of monster romance, how we got here, what it means, and kind of give us a couple more options on if you're interested in the sort of media, where to look.
And you mean how we got here as like a population as a whole, not just us specifically,
No, not just us
right?
specifically. I mean, sort of like, yeah. I mean, in terms of why people like this, why there is such an interest in it. I mean, The Shape of Water won a couple of Oscars for this movie, which, if you know anything about genre films, is incredible because
Incredible, yeah.
one, horror never wins, and two, like, fantasy never wins, really. Unless you're Lord of the Rings, but that's something else entirely. So yeah, it's a big deal. A lot of people are into this, and I think it's meaningful to talk about why. So next time, we'll have that exploration.
Yes. And until next time, again, if you've enjoyed our content with this new season or our previous episodes, if you're revisiting those, we would love for you to rate and review us. Always a plus. And as always, don't hesitate to reach out to us. Let us know what you want to hear. Let us know your thoughts on these things. Let us know which fish people you would fuck.
Well, let us know what monsters that have always intrigued you, too.
So until next time, go watch these movies, do your homework.
Culture Cryptids is recorded, produced, and engineered by me, JD.
And me, Corey. You can find us on social media at Culture Cryptids on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
Questions, comments, corrections, hate mail? Email us at culturecryptids@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.
The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of Knox Pride.